Welcome to the Corporate Treasury 101 podcast. In today's episode, we discuss treasury policy and education with Jason Murphy from Centrus and the IACT, the Irish Association of Corporate Treasurers. Jason is co-founder and chief strategy officer at Centrus. He has 25 years investment banking and financial advisory experience, and Centrus is an independent financial services group that believes in finance with purpose. In the episode of today, expect to learn, why is debt more risky than equity? How is a treasury policy typically drafted? What are the key skills and knowledge areas that modern treasurers need to be equipped with? How does the IACT contribute to the professional development of treasurers in Ireland and around the globe? And what are some of the programs or initiatives it offers? And like always, much, much more. We hope you will enjoy the episode. If that is the case, and when you're thinking about how you found our podcast, chances are that it was through word of mouth, social media, or a recommendation from your favorite podcast platform. And this is our only request to you. The best way you can support the podcast, wherever you're listening to this, is to head to Apple Podcasts, search for Corporate Treasury 101, and give us a 5-star review. That will mean the world to us and help more people learn about treasury. And with all that being said, please welcome Jason Murphy. Jason, thank you so much for coming on the Corporate Treasury 101 podcast. We are going to talk about today treasury policies, treasury education, and the last one, I'm not going to spoil it, but stay till the end of the episode to discover which one. So starting with treasury policy, that's actually something we have not covered on the podcast yet, at least extensively. So Jason, please, can you explain to our listeners what a treasury policy is?
And thank you for having me on the show. You know, delighted to be here. To some extent, treasury policy is the start. And what I'm what I mean by that is, you know, whether you're playing soccer or whether you're a corporate treasurer, normally there are lines on a field and there's a rule book. The policy statement is your lines on your field. It's your goalposts, it's your rule book. In some cases, what you find is that in an organization, and particularly some of the smaller organizations, the policy and how treasury works is kind of part of the finance function. It's kind of almost buried in all of the other bits that you do. And sometimes it's not even very explicit. In the larger organizations, you have a very clear treasury management policy. As an advisor, it's probably the first thing I look for when I speak to a new client. In terms of that policy is going to give you as a treasurer or as somebody working in that department a very clear picture as to how the organization wants to manage treasury. And what I mean by the organization is, and I'm sure you've talked about this at many different podcasts before, but where treasury sits in the organization is often different depending on the organization. So when I talk about the full organization, I mean everything from shareholder to board right down to executive. So the policy is typically approved at board level, and it sets forth and helps with the strategy that's ultimately set by the board coming from the shareholders. So it's right at the heart of everything that happens within treasury. So that's the starting point, I guess, of policy. The word policy most people will be familiar with. And it's no different in treasury and our treasury management. I think what people sometimes consider to be treasury, which is one area of treasury, which is cash and liquidity management, they would probably find in most organizations some level of cash management parameters, some level of liquidity policies, etc. But the treasury policy document is much broader. And I can go into that in much more detail if you want, Kilian, no problem.
Yeah, we will. To continue on the soccer/football, depending on where those people are listening to us on. To continue on this analogy, on the soccer field, as a player, for instance,
I should be knowing the rules. If I don't, I have a referee, like, you know, just enforcing those rules. Is there an equivalent in the Treasury Department? And I'm asking because I've seen it and I know the answer, but I would like to hear it from you.
Is there a referee? Well, first of all, I suppose I coach an under 12 girls soccer team, right? And
cool.
I really love that, actually. But it's when you talk about the referee enforcing the rules. So sometimes somebody does something by accident, so they don't intend to have a foul. And other times it's deliberate, right? And the referee has to make decisions at all points in time. Is it one or the other? Within Treasury, obviously you've layers of responsibility. And one of the things I would say about Treasury that's similar to soccer is you have segregation of duties. So you definitely don't want your midfield doing what your defence is supposed to be doing, and et cetera, et cetera. Your goalkeeper running out and scoring a goal at the top end unless it's last second. So within the Treasury area, clearly you have an interaction with compliance and the compliance department. And often one of the major risks that we talk about and that sits inside the Treasury management policy is the legal and regulatory policy, because that helps you to manage legal and regulatory risks within the organization that pertain to Treasury. So you will have a policy statement around legal and regulatory policy and all of those different risks. So compliance sits there, but also typically a treasurer would report to the CFO or to the board, and they also have an oversight responsibility as well.
That makes lots of sense. I guess the rules book in a soccer environment, let's say, is also here to make it equal wherever you play football, soccer. When it comes to treasury, a treasury policy can vary from department to department. Obviously, treasurers are the custodians of cash, but also the risk managers, if not risk mitigators. So at the end of the day, there's always more or less the same spirit. But you can have very different approaches to certain specific treasury tasks. Why is that?
One of the big reasons is risk appetite. And it's one of the big reasons that things change. We talk about this when I'm lecturing in Treasury all the time about the risk appetite of the board. One of the most basic areas that treasurers get involved in is the capital structure strategy. And part of that is this determining how much equity and how much debt you want in your capital structure. The risk appetite, again, of the board comes really to play on that, because obviously if the board are less risky and want to take less risk, they'll have less debt in the capital structure, notwithstanding the fact that debt's, you know, typically cheaper from a weighted average cost of capital perspective. So that risk appetite piece really has a key part to play. And if you think about it, it's very analogous to soccer as well, because the footballing philosophy of a Manchester City might be very different to the footballing philosophy of a West Ham or a Paris Saint-Germain. And when you think about that in that context, that philosophy coming down, that risk appetite, whether you want to play five up front or one, that has a major impact on the type of policy you set and the parameters upon which you want the people within the Treasury function to operate.
So now I'm going to ask a very, very newbie question, but it's genuine from my side. Why, in the explanation you gave, it feels like debt is more risky than equity?
Well, if you're an owner of a company, you are the equity, okay? So normally you're in control and you're making all the decisions. If you receive additional equity capital, additional equity capital sits alongside you, typically if it's the same type of equity, takes the same risks you do, but typically equity doesn't have a hard repayment date, nor does it have a defined interest cost or sum that you have to pay. So if you increase the debt in your capital structure, you are increasing these hard repayment dates on which you must give the capital back. And by definition, from a liquidity standpoint, as well as everything else, and refinancing risk, etc., you're increasing the risk in the capital structure, because at some point, if you can't pay back that debt, the debt holders may enforce, especially if they've got security, and equity, because debt sits ahead of equity, equity will lose out. So that's why, from an equity standpoint, typically when you are taking on debt, the more debt you take on, the more risk you're considered to be taking within your capital structure.
I love that. And then you mentioned debt is eventually cheaper. Is it because a shareholder might ask for more dividends than what a debt will cost for the same amount?
In the very first principles, debt is typically cheaper because it sits ahead of you in the waterfall to get paid back. So by definition, it gets its money back faster than you would. So when you're clearing your capital structure, you clear your debt first, then your equity. So by definition, debt tends to be, if you're a debt holder, and now we talk about it from the perspective of the debt holder as opposed to the company. And this is something that I spend a lot of time talking to my students about, because you get confused when you're talking about it. Am I looking at it from the perspective of the person providing the capital or receiving the capital? So when I'm the person providing the capital, then I can charge less of my debt because I sit ahead of equity. From the company perspective, obviously that means the cost of that capital is typically lower, but also what we often find is that interest cost on debt is tax deductible, whereas obviously dividends come after tax.
I love that. Okay, sorry for that tangent, but that's super interesting. So, and I'm also going to keep the football analogy because I just love it. My next question is, why is a treasury policy important? Because I could be like, you know what, let's just go free for all. Everybody goes on the field and just shoot in the ball as hard as you can, and you know, send some cheeky tackles and so on. Why would a treasury policy be important? And maybe to add a bit of actually serious flavor to this, there is regulation. We anyways, as treasurers, eventually know what we can and cannot do because it's the law, right, on the country or international laws. Why is a treasury policy important?
If you take one example from a policy point of view, let's take what I would call your borrowing and refinancing policy that sits inside your typical treasury management policy. That borrowing and refinancing policy will normally, by the board, set you a borrowing limit, which means that without that limit, you're leaving it free to the treasurer to continue to keep borrowing until such time as he gets to a point where he or she can't borrow anymore. And you've highly levered the company. So you've probably taken on more risk than the board wanted you to. So you don't want people running off doing that. Similarly, but conversely to that, you could sit there and say, without a liquidity policy, we will allow our cash balances to fall to zero. Whereas a typical good liquidity policy will give a minimum cash balance in the organization that typically, on average, will cover 25% of fixed costs. So about a quarter of your annual fixed cost base in cash held to show that you have some level of liquidity in your business. You could also talk about interest rates, and you could say, if I don't have a treasury policy that tells me whether I should fix my interest rate risk, fix my interest rates to manage my interest rate risk, or what percentage I should fix, then you could leave all of your interest rate risk completely unhedged and therefore cause major problems from a P&L or a cash flow perspective.
Quite topical. Is there a certain size as of which a company must have a treasury policy? And here, I mean, obviously you want a treasury policy as soon as you have a treasury department, I guess. But are there stages where it's much more critical to have a strong treasury policy in place and enforced eventually compared to another size where it's like, okay, we have so much on our plate anyways, it's a department of one person, so it won't necessarily happen. How does it work company size wise?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question, because firstly, I would say a treasury management statement or policy all companies should have, even if they're one person company, they should have something upon which they sit there and say, I'm going to look at all of these risks and I'm going to determine in my own, even if I'm on my own, how I'm going to manage those risks. So I'd say treasury policy or statement for every company. However, the size of that policy and statement, is it a one pager or is it a 25 pages? Often some of the treasury management policies we work with clients on can be 30, 35 pages long. So is it a one pager or 35 pager? Often depends on the complexity of the treasury environment that you're in. So how many financial market risks are you trying to manage within that environment? Do you have debt? Remember, there are some of the biggest companies in the world are very cash rich. They have no debt. So the size of their components of their treasury management policy that deal with debt are often quite small, because it says simply, we will not borrow any debt. or you need to come back to board if you're going to do so. So I would tailor the size of your treasury policy to some extent by the complexity as opposed to the full size of the business. But everybody should have one, yeah.
So now that's super interesting. I would expect, so what do you call debt exactly? Because for me, a line of credit is debt. And even the biggest company out there have lines of credit, right? Whether they are drawing on it or not is another question. But I'm interested by that statement of saying biggest companies in this world have so much cash that they don't have debt. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I'm an accountant, by the way, by profession. So I love these kind of questions that cross over the accounting world into the treasury world. What I mean by debt is when you borrow from a lending institution on the basis of having to pay them back over a period of time. That's what I mean by debt. You're dead right in saying that to some extent, if you receive goods from somebody or you receive services from somebody and they send you a bill, until you pay that bill, by definition, as you said, there's a debt. And the biggest companies in the world will have that. But they may not have gone out to a bank or a lending institution and looked for a credit line to borrow X amount of million or even have a revolving credit facility because their cash balances are so high. When I'm doing studies with some of my students, we often study that sort of operating cash cycle amongst different companies. And what you see with some of the biggest companies in the world, some of the really big tech companies, they almost produce their goods on a made-to-order basis, which means that from a debtor perspective, they're often getting paid before they provide the product. And on the supplier side, the supplier is giving, you know, the credit terms they're getting could be 90 days. So their operating cash flow cycle is funding their business. They don't even need debt in that context. And that's not the case for a lot of retail companies. It's not the case for a lot of businesses. So there's a big difference between the two.
So an accounting definition of debt is basically borrowing from a lending institution that you have to repay. From a treasury standpoint, it could be any line of credit that you have set up. But if I'm not drawing on my overdraft nightly, oh man, it's been a while that I haven't seen one of those. So it's interesting to have those definitions. Am I in the clear here or am I mixing your stuff?
No, you're slightly off piste, I think.
Put me back on track.
So yes, accounting definition, if you think about it from the perspective of assets and liabilities, that's the simplest way to think about it. So in liabilities, you'll often have current liabilities, which includes trade debt, trade creditors, okay? So these are people that you've received a good or service, but you haven't paid them yet. So that's a form of debt in a way, because you've received the product, but you haven't paid yet. But it's not the definition of debt that I'm using. The definition of debt I'm using is you get down into your long-term liabilities and you have borrowed under a facility agreement of some form from a lending institution, and you have to pay that back, and there's an interest cost associated with it. The bit in the middle, which I think is the bit you're kind of referring to, is where you have a bank overdraft or a working capital facility that you haven't drawn on. A working capital facility for me is still debt. Even though you haven't drawn on it, it's a line of credit. So I'd still put it in that overall debt definition. And the same with any kind of liquidity facility or RCF. But that trade creditors, I wouldn't call that debt. I'd call that creditors.
So in a treasury policy, you'd obviously have a debt section, an interest rate hedging section. What else do you have in there? What is typically in a treasury policy?
Let's unlock the mystery.
Please, let's bust that one open.
A little bit. Well, you would typically have a liquidity risk policy. So this is going to be sitting in there talking to you about minimum cash balances, cash flow forecasts, you know, 1 week, 12 week, 1 year, long-term, medium-term cash flow forecasts. You would also have, and I think some people, they probably talk about this, but it's more specific in a lot of treasury policies around security. So how much of the asset pool are you willing to securitize against any kind of debts that you would take on? Credit counterparty risk is a critical one. Credit counterparty risk in the context of, you know, what terms you might give to suppliers, what ratings you're happy to enter into long-term contracts with certain companies, also the ratings of your banks. So what we find in a lot of treasury policies is that they will be a maximum percentage you can have with any one bank, and there'll be a maximum percentage you can have inside various different rating categories from AAA all the way to BBB. So what you're looking for is that kind of diversified risk sitting inside that credit counterparty policy. And then you have operational risk policy, which is all about the different risks in the business operationally, you know, fraud, corruption, all the different things that can happen, all the bad things, or just mistakes, you know, and payment issues. So you have that operational risk policy that kind of tries to outline exactly how we're going to do things. Part of that operational risk policy is also looking at some covenants that you might have on loan agreements, because if you don't meet those covenants, then you could end up in a situation where you're in default. So that's clearly an operational risk that you have to manage. So reporting and monitoring becomes part of that.
So that's quite a lot. How do I, let's say I'm a fresh treasurer arriving into a couple of billions dollars of revenues a year company, and I'm asked to draft a treasury policy from scratch. We actually had somebody from an FTSE company asking us, hey, do you guys help us treasury policy draft? So there are companies that just either have grown significantly faster than any other, or like just didn't have a proper treasury policy in place, or an outdated one and want to redo it from scratch. Let's say I'm one of those treasurers. Where do you recommend me to start?
Well, that's a big question. So, you know, you're in a billion-dollar company, and you want to sort of either have a very sort of not fit for purpose treasury policy, or you want to get, you know, you have no policy, and you want to try and get to best practice somehow. So, most obvious place is hire an advisor who can bring all that best practice to play, because they will have seen it across multiple different organizations. They will have their own probably standard templates they can bring to bear and help with that. If you wanted to get a feel for what the whole thing looks like, there's a lot of treasury policies which are actually published online, you know, by various different organizations. Yeah, they're few and far between, but they're there in terms of if you go and do a search. But talk to peers. One of the things that we try to do, and obviously I think you may have mentioned in the start, I'm vice president of the Irish Association of Corporate Treasurers. One of the things about treasury associations is if you join those associations, obviously you get access to all of the other members that are in there. And you can often do peer-to-peer work where you reach out to the association and say, look, I've got a question. It could be treasury policy, could be FX hedging, could be anything. I'd like to talk to some peers about what they do, what's best practice. That's often it's a comfort zone that you can operate in without having to tell the world, hi, I'm group treasurer, but I haven't a clue what a treasury policy is. You know.
So that's an interesting one. And do you think, I mean, you see it obviously, but I'm curious to know if a treasurer, even within that safe environment, will be also willing to share the treasury policy. Isn't it something like, I don't know, trade secret? Like, hey, yeah, we hedge as of this threshold, and actually we are quite eager on risk when it comes to interest rate. I don't know, these kind of things are like, actually we are over leveraged because our policy allows us to do so, which is risky in the eyes of the market, but also allows us to have exponential growth on this industry. I don't know. Is it something people share easily?
I wouldn't say they share any of that easily at all. I would say most of the people in that environment can at least help you to write the basic policy. So they may not refer specifically to their own circumstances, but they can at least refer to what's best practice in each one of the different pieces. And what they can also do is, you know, they can give you an indication of what they've seen themselves in the past, you know, around generally what would be appropriate in these types of organizations. The real best place to go when you get into that level of detail where you want comfort is probably to hire an advisor who's got the expertise and is dealing with it day to day and can bring that expertise to bear.
How much does that cost to hire an advisor to draft a treasury policy? You don't have to give your rate, Jason, but just to have an idea.
Yeah, look, I mean, it can be very, very cost effective. You know, generally speaking, when somebody comes on board, and it depends on the size of the organization. So go back to your original point, which is a valid one. You know, if you're talking about a very small organization, you could be talking anywhere between 5,000 and 15,000 euros to get a treasury policy drafted. If it's a much bigger organization and you're looking at multiple different risks, you know, that could go up to sort of 40,000-50,000 euros. But it tends to depend on the size of the organization. And often what you find is that there is some level of the Treasury policy sitting there. So really, actually, what the advisor is doing is updating it to best practice. And that's, again, a very small exercise more than anything else. Most advisors don't do that as a sort of a, how would you put it, a single exercise. You know, they often do it as part of a review of the Treasury operation. So they'll look at your Treasury policy. They look at how the operation is actually functioning, you know, what we would probably call a health check, you know, across the Treasury. So look at how your systems are interacting with each other, look at how you're managing risk, look to see if there's any best practice gaps, and make some recommendations as part of that report, as well as updating the Treasury policy.
Coming from a consulting slash advisory background myself, am I assuming correctly that you could, I mean, the exercise could consist into doing a form of as-is analysis, saying, okay, this is what we have right now. Let's also look at what we want to include in the Treasury policy and therefore look at how we operate today, whether there is room for improvement, kind of a to-be design, and say, okay, that's where we want to go. That's how the Treasury should look like based on those needs and what you're doing right now. Also based on where you want to go. And then there is the kind of policy draft and then implementation of it, which is not to be overlooked. But that's kind of how it would go.
Step by step, exactly. And depending on how much time, because remember, you know, inside Treasury functions or inside finance functions, there's a lot of competing priorities. And I think you alluded to it at the start, you know, in terms of, is the policy seen as, oh, you know, we don't want to have this document that we just put in the bottom shelf, gathers dust, you know, we develop it because we have to, and then we're not living it. I think that's a dangerous place to be, because there's a whole set of rules in that. And if you're not familiar with it, you'll break them. So, you know, I think if you're going to go to the trouble of doing it, you live it. But often what we find is that it steps, you know, with organizations, what you find is a new treasurer comes in, where there's been an older sort of grouping of treasurers for maybe the last 20, 30 years, new treasurer comes in and he goes, or she goes, look, I actually need to look at this. I need somebody independent to come in and take a look at all of this with me and help me to think about it. And it's often having that second pair of eyes that's helpful.
I love that. So, Jason, from what you've seen, what are some key components that should be included in an effective treasury policy? And by that, I mean, so you've given us the main topics that are covered into a treasury policy, but how do you make it efficient? The reason I'm asking this is, it's very easy to have a, you know, as you say, 10, 30, 50, I've seen some 120 pages documents that document everything and like the best practice, how things should be done, how it should effectively be managed in each region, say you're a multinational. But like, what are the key components to make sure that it's at the same time providing enough value and guidance, but also not being too much precise that at the end of the day, that's totally inapplicable in the real life. How do you find that balance? And what are the key components to ensure that balance and make sure that the treasury policy is actually applied?
Yeah, well, I like the concept of trees, okay?
Me too. Trees are amazing.
And this is, again, going back to... In fact, I was actually talking to one of my students, actually to the class a few weeks ago. And sometimes when you use an analogy, Guillaume, as you know, when we talk about soccer, you never know where the analogy resonates with people. But anyway, we were talking about treasury, and I said, one of the students asked me, what's the best piece of advice you could give us going into a treasury career? And I said, it's like an analogy that was given to me by a very good friend of mine who's French, and must be good advice. And he said to me, he said, Jason, he said, whether it be in treasury or in your career, you need to think about it this way. Never be an oak tree, always be a bamboo. He said, because the oak tree, it's stubborn, it sits there, it can't, it's not nimble, it can't move, whereas a bamboo just blows with the wind, and that's what you need to be. You need to move and be nimble with the wind. And I always thought that was a really good way of thinking about sort of, you know, how to adapt in careers and life and stuff. But anyway, how I got onto that was the three. So the 1, 2, 3. So I like threes, right? And when I'm talking to the students about the whole area of treasury, I break it down into three buckets, okay? And I think treasury policy, very simply, can be broken down probably into three buckets. So one is cash and liquidity management. Two is financial risk management, and three is capital structure financing. Okay. So in cash and liquidity management, you're going to deal with everything from size of cash balances to cash flow forecasting to liquidity facilities to trying to manage your anything that sits in terms of cash management systems, netting, pooling, all of that good stuff. That's all going to sit in cash and liquidity management. Financial and operational risk management, that's going to be managing all of the key financial market risks. So interest rate, FX, inflation, commodity, and two new ones for you, Guillaume, that are becoming very popular with our clients.
AI, AI.
That's more popular in terms of risks in the education sector. We'll come on to that, but two new ones that we're constantly coming across now: power price risk management, power price risk management. In every market that companies operate in, they use energy. And energy prices have become more and more volatile, as you've seen over the last number of years. So inside a lot of the new treasury policies that are just coming out and that we're working with clients on, they are now implementing policies around how they manage power price risk. So that's become really, 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 really forefront of what we're doing. And the other interesting one that's reasonably new as well, is how clients manage the sort of nitty-gritty of certain commodities, okay? But whether it's dairy or whether it is fuel prices, which we see a lot, they're becoming more and more integral inside treasury policies. Before, they were almost an academic exercise, or they were very company specific. But now, even with carbon credits and things like that, there's a lot of different aspects of commodities that people are trying to deal with. So they're two new ones. So as I said, bucket A, cash and liquidity management. Once you cover those key points I mentioned, that's your treasury policy there. Co bucket B, financial and operational risk management. Cover those key buckets. And the final one is capital structure financing. And that's all about debt levels, relationships with banks, treasury capital structure strategy, credit ratings, and relationships with investors, etc. That's what sits in. So once you cover those three buckets, you know, there's bits that sit underneath it, you know, everything from performance measurement to decision making to budgeting to money laundering to staff training, all of that goes into another bucket. But those three ones will get you a good chunk of the way there.
And so for each of those, am I correct to assume that you would have kind of in its structure, like the kind of objective of the policy itself, maybe some roles and responsibilities to segregate properly who does what within that bucket, and then some form of reporting as well, like, hey, it's good to have those in place, but we also want to be able to monitor them. And for that, we need to have somebody, person A, reporting to person B about metric C, and so on and so forth. And that's how you overall have your.
Correct. Think about it in four ways. Set the objective, set the rules, set the procedures, and then report and monitor on it.
Makes a lot of sense. So, how have you seen kind of the treasury policy design, implementation, or overall writing evolve over the last couple of years, Jason? Have you been into any kind of work or like seen any evolution on that side?
The evolution has been, I believe, relatively extreme in that I think the risks sitting inside Treasury are better understood now than they were 10 years ago. The way we talk about Treasury and the professionalism of Treasury within organizations has definitely improved. There's a much better understanding of what I would call legal, tax, jurisdictional issues around Treasury and how Treasury accounting has come to bear in terms of decision making around treasury policy and treasury transactions than it has been for a long time. In fact, in most organizations now, what you find is the tax and treasury gets brought together. The treasury accountants become really important in terms of being able to advise and work through things. And obviously the legal department then, in the context of, you know, multiple different subsidiaries, different jurisdictions, different legal regulatory requirements. I think when you look at it, part of that's driven by the regulatory rules that have changed over time. You know, we have had what I would call an increase in regulation over the last 10 years. But we've also had a more complex environment for financial instruments and financial management. And when you think about some of the challenges that we have faced, you know, as a set of corporates, over the last sort of 5-6 years, whether it's been COVID or various other things that have happened, those challenges have brought us to think very differently about treasury. I mean, I say to my students, treasury is the most important function, right?
Isn't that obvious that they come into this and are aware of this already?
I'm very objective, obviously.
Zero bias in this podcast episode.
Zero bias. But the reason is, when you start leaving treasury aside, when you start your job, or even when you start to train as an accountant, one of the first things you learn is cash is king. And who is the person in the organization that manages cash? Cash is the treasurer. So even if you go back to first principles, it's such an important function. So I think it's beginning to get elevated in terms of its status. And that has meant more sophistication and policy development has become better, I think, and more strategic. And that's probably the word I use most of my students today, actually, is that Treasury is a strategic partner now, not just the person who manages the cash flow forecast and does various operational transactions. They're becoming a strategic partner, helping the CFO with capital structure strategy, with financial risk management strategy, with cash and liquidity management strategy. They're becoming that strategic partner to the board. And that elevation has adapted its way all the way through into policy.
And I will add to this, for almost a decade, a bit more, cash has been pretty easily accessible on the markets. Interest rates were pretty low. We had ups and downs in everything. But what we've seen happening in the last couple of years is, well, obviously the interest rates have been rising like crazy. And now they're about to decrease a bit. But so with all this comes interest rate risk management, right? Because when you have a 0.5% or 1% interest rate, it's not the same story as 5 or 6. But also the impact it has on, as you said, financial risk management in the sense of foreign exchange risk management being linked to this. So you have this spotlight on the treasurer because all of a sudden we have FX loss or kind of quite heavy changes in the debt cost. All right, but wait, who is responsible for this? Well, those people, but they didn't have any budget to do any hedging, let alone identifying exposure. Oh, let's actually look into this. So becoming quite central, which is a good thing for our profession, obviously.
And probably, Gillian, just to add one thing to that we've seen in the last 12 months become much more highlighted in treasury management policy is the area of performance management, because performance measurement, I should say, really, because for a long time, treasurers were not measured on return on cash because it was either negative or zero for a long time. Whereas now, treasurers are expected to be able to optimize their cash balances, get decent, you know, interest rate returns on that cash. And that has to be brought to bear in the policy in terms of, you know, what's the expectation and how deliverable is it?
Wow, that's interesting. So have you seen treasurers getting this as a KPI? I don't know, in their yearly?
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, even within policy, there would be an expectation of a minimum return based on where rates are, etc. Yeah,
that's pretty cool. Definitely a topic for a future episode. Who knows? Jason, changing gear a bit, and you've mentioned it a couple of times. You have students. Let's talk a bit about treasury education. And I like it because it links a bit with treasury policy in the sense of, like, you know, training people so they can properly apply treasury principles and execute on treasury. In your view, where does the treasury education stand today?
It's a really good question because it's something I think about a lot, right? You know, as a lecturer in the area, I challenge myself at the start of every academic year to provide a level of education to the students that's very practical. So that's my biggest challenge. Yes, there are academic principles, like in every single discipline, that you have to understand, for sure. And there's a reason you have to understand them. But the challenge I set myself every year is, how do I make this practical? How do I ensure when students leave this classroom and they go for a job interview or they end up in a finance department, they've learned something that they can apply in principle, right, to that organization? That is a really big challenge. And when you think about the academic side of treasury, and I'm not saying that it's necessarily that different to anywhere else, but one of the sort of very, very starting points of any lecture I give in the area of financial risk management is I look at a graph of the, say, for example, sterling euro exchange rate. And I look at that graph over the last 7, 8 years. And I'll say to the students, I'll identify where the peaks and troughs are. So where the real volatile movement has happened. And I'll, you know, we'll have talked probably for about half an hour on all the reasons that FX rates move, right? So the academic 6 reasons, key reasons they move. And then I'll ask them to put their hand up and identify which one caused each one of those points. Okay. And they all do. And then without fail, all of them point to one of the 6. And I turn around and I say to them, none of those 6 caused those movements. It was Brexit, COVID, etc. So it's this concept within Treasury education of trying to bring the practical back into the classroom, where you realize that when you're operating as a treasurer in an organization, there's a lot of stuff happening in the markets that you can't just simply calculate. You have to understand how the markets work, how risks happen, how risks materialize, and then apply those in a practical way. So a long-winded way of saying the status of Treasury education, I feel, is probably not practical enough right now. And that is the biggest challenge that I think we all face. Yes, learn the absolute basics in terms of the academics, but let's try and get more practice into the education so that when the students leave, they actually leave with a form of training as well as an academic record.
Let me play the devil's advocate here a bit, Jason. How do you do that? How do you train people to have practical skills when it comes to treasury? Because I've done my time as an interim treasurer as part of my advisory role. And what you see is that treasurers have a very specific set of tasks, but also some things coming on top. And you have to know a system, which is the system used by the company, which encompasses a whole bunch of rules. At the end of the day, in some maybe less advanced treasury departments, you end up spending part of your day just keying in some information or bank account details or payments. Speaking of experience here, like the practical is actually just knowing how to navigate your TMS or even how to be super efficient in Excel, because you end up downloading this bunch of reports that are in CSV and you need to transform them into probable workable format. You see where I'm going here? Like, how do you do that in a curriculum, saying, hey, the reality of the treasury world is this, so this is what you need to be able to do, and here is how you can, because I guess the students of yours also want to grow, so then this is how you put your hands up and say, hey, I can do this, or let me take initiative on that. How do you practically do that in realistic terms?
Yeah, I mean, as I said, it's a challenge I set myself every year, and it's very, very difficult. You know, when I talk in the classroom about credit ratings, I don't talk about it in the context of here's the S&P methodology, here's the Fitch methodology, you know, here's some ratings that have been done. I talk about it in the context of actual real life examples and why Fitch or S&P have made certain calls in terms of that rating criteria on those companies. So why is that? And why is that different? And then compare and contrast. So we use cases to help the students to kind of really see the real world examples of things as opposed to the pure academics. That's one way. The other way is interaction. You know, often in the classroom, we sit there and we talk about why certain things are academically a particular way and why they might actually be different in practice. So it's really getting the conversation flowing. I encourage the students to ask me questions outside the classroom, send me emails, you know, thoughts, concerns they have, things that, you know, and we talk a little bit about, you know, what an actual treasurer will do in the real world. The best way, though, and this is the little secret that I'm about to give you.
Spoiler alert. Wait, let's keep the tension a bit.
So the best way is I bring in.
And we're going to come back after an ad break. Come back in 10 minutes. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jason.
That's brilliant. I love that. The best way is I bring in guest lecturers who are treasurers, and they talk about a day in their life, and they talk about the real world of getting up every morning and what they face and what they don't face, and then they take questions and answers from the students. I think that is that really brings the academic into practice. But it's a huge challenge. You can't do it. It's not like you've got, in my course, you don't have a 3-year training record that you have to fill out in Treasury like you do in accounting. And that could be something for the future, in terms of Treasury, maybe Treasury will follow the path that the accountants have followed and say, well, look, you need to, yes, do your exams, but you also need to do a 3-year training record as a treasurer in order to become a fully practiced treasurer.
Love that secret. What are the key skills and knowledge you're trying to pass on to your students? And by that, I mean, what is it that is expected from them from a hard skill standpoint? As you said, there is the very basic academic set of skills. So I imagine linking back to the treasury policy, because that relates to the direct treasury task, right? Cash and liquidity management, fundamental of this, capital structure, same thing. What is financial risk management? Okay, that's the hard skill kind of knowledge that you need to know by heart, if not a bit by heart. When it comes to actually evolving into a treasury department and also in terms of soft skills, what are you trying to equip your students with to go into this world of treasury, which is the most important function, by the way?
What are the key skills? That's a difficult question because, key skills, when you think about what I was saying back about strategy, right? I could talk, and this is what I'd like to talk about, right? I could talk about leadership and management being a critical skill set of a treasurer. Most treasurers I talk to are really skilled leaders, right? Because they lead departments, or they've had to work and lead multi teams under high pressure environments to get to being group treasurer, right? So leadership and management skills, probably number one in most contexts. Number two, business and finance skills, right? Treasury shouldn't be devoid from the business, right? Or split out or separated. Business and finance skills, definitely very, very important. Risk management skills, absolutely. You have to be able to understand how to, and I think you get a lot of that from the classroom, the academic side of it at least. Then when you get into the practical world, dealing with banks, negotiating on hedges and stuff like that becomes important. But you can't get away from being a good communicator and a good negotiator. If you're not a good communicator and a good negotiator, it's very hard to be a good treasurer. There's no doubt about that. Communication, negotiation. And then you get into the things that you probably talk about straight off, which would be, modeling, planning, analysis type stuff. Technology, most treasurers have to have a really decent interaction with technology now, and data management, right? We can go on for days with data management and be a good project manager. I think everybody has to be, even in your own life, you have to be a good project manager these days.
So I love everything you said, Jason, but one in particular, which is business management. Treasury is often, and there is some truth in that, referred to as a support function, which it is by essence. I strongly believe, and we with Usam at Corporate Treasury 101, strongly believe that it can be a strategic partner in the sense of, hey, where is my cash and what are we doing out of this? Let me actually bring value out of this cash. But it is a treasury function as well. And what you say about business management is so good and so fundamental. Like, let's not overlook the fact of being able to understand the industry we are in, understand the business model our company is following, where are we adding value to the clients, how are we managing with the suppliers. I think if you're able to connect the dots between the business model, your company, and your role in the treasury function, you will grow in your career exponentially. It's like that's how it's done. At least that's what I strongly believe in. Jason, I want to touch upon the IACT, but lastly on the treasury education. What about literature? Is there any good treasury literature out there? What do you recommend your clients? Like, when it comes to people wanting to read a book, where do you direct them exactly?
There are lots of books that are out there. They cover the academic components of treasury, right? So they'll explain to you how an interest rate forward is calculated, how you calculate forward points on an FX forward and things like that. And they talk about cash management and netting and pooling, etc. That's something I struggle with, if I'm honest. There are lots of books, and I do reference a few of them with students. But I've not seen something recently that you could just take off the shelves and go, right, you know, here's my three buckets of treasury. Here's an up-to-date view on how treasuries, I mean, even the treasury policy area isn't really covered that well in literature, the thing we discussed about for a while. You know, technology moves so fast in treasury, you know, a book, I mean, I think the reference books for my course are probably 10 years old. They still talk about checks. there's not many checks going on in the real world anymore in terms of payments, you know, digital currencies, etc. It's all evolving.
True. So just jumping in here, Jason, sorry to interrupt, but before our US friends assassinate us, because I had somebody reaching out to us for exactly that. We did a specific episode for checks. Actually, there are some areas in the world where it's still used, and in the US, it's still a big thing. But indeed, where we are right now, in Western Europe, it's less used, and as we tend to go towards more digital means of payment, checks tend to disappear, but still a bit used in the US. But I see what you mean. So, Jason, are you saying that we need to write a book together on treasury?
I have to say it is something on my agenda at some point that you know, there's a very valid, but again, going back to your point, you know, I think if you were to write a book on it, you would keep it very short. You know, you would actually go to first principles, you know, and the practical components of being a treasurer, as opposed to all of the academic stuff, because the academic stuff is covered to some extent out there, but something that's really practical, really, and almost the kind of thing where if you walked in today as group treasurer, it was your first day as group treasurer, what are the key things you need to cover off in that first sort of 90 days that you're in that role?
I love that. That gives me plenty of ideas. Let's not spoil everything right now. Jason, we are arriving towards the end of the interview, and first of all, I loved all the insights. I want to keep the last 5 minutes for the IACT. So we already talked extensively about the IACT with Amy Cullen, who is still, I think, the current president of the association, talking about what you guys do there, what you stand for, the mission. One thing we didn't dig into that much with Amy is the education part of it. And I feel that leads nicely into everything we've covered here. So please walk me through, what's the role of the IACT when it comes to education in Ireland, but also I feel worldwide, in the sense that it's really trying to get in a place where the IACT becomes a reference. So what are you guys doing there? What are the projects? What are you holding for us in the future? Give us the whole shebang.
Firstly, you know, we're a charity, and our charitable objective is actually all around education. So it's at the foundation of our entire organization. I've led the education pillar for a number of years in the IACT, and some of the things that we're doing within that pillar involve working with universities and linking with universities around the area of treasury. So we've invited students from certain universities, and we're going to expand that into our student membership. We've brought them to conferences that we're running. We've given them the opportunity for networking events, etc. So that linkage with the universities is a critical one. And with some of the big education providers, we've done linkages with the likes of ACCA and others to do different seminars together, etc. One of the critical components of the education platform we have is the events that we hold, right? So we do lots of different events throughout the year where we try to pick topics that are important to treasurers and topical, and bring our treasurer community together to discuss those and have guest speakers, etc. So we have lots of those kind of educational events alongside some thought leadership that we publish on the website. Some of the more, I guess, I would call unique parts of what we do. We have a mentoring program, so where young treasurers can come in and be mentored by more senior treasurers. So we match up within our membership younger treasurers with senior treasurers, and we help them through a program, and we get professional coaches involved, etc., as well, to help with that and bring and support along the way. And that's been quite successful. We've had a number of those young treasurers get more and more senior, and hopefully at some point they'll become mentors as well within the organization. So that bit is. And finally, this year we're launching, we probably haven't fully announced this yet, but our plan is to launch a graduate program within the IACT. So Within that, our plan is to have a number of companies take a student from one of the university treasury modules into their organization for 3 6-month periods. And at the end, obviously, hopefully they will have a career in treasury. So that's something we're hoping to launch this year at our graduate program. So we're trying as best we can to really link with education as well as the practical side of what's happening within our membership, and be innovative as much as we can do in the area of treasury education.
Absolutely, absolutely love that. It makes a lot of sense. So that's kind of exclusive information here, the announcement of the graduate program, Jason.
Well, we haven't formally launched it yet. So by the time this podcast goes out, hopefully we'll have launched it at that point.
We'll make sure that the stars align when we do so. And to link it back with one of the things you said that you do with your own teaching, I guess having those treasurers handy that can actually spread this knowledge, this know-how, is like a huge advantage for the ICT, because it's basically a gathering of like big A game players, kind of treasurers, especially since Ireland is quite a hub for that. So anywhere you can go, you who are listening to this, where there is a concentration of treasurers, there is such a concentration of knowledge that goes along with it, and that's how you can eventually learn a lot from. So definitely not only the treasury education space, but also getting mentored. And I love this program. I didn't know about it. Actually, that's really, really cool. I guess also in terms of career growth, being accompanied by somebody who is more senior than you, who have been there, done that, and like steering you in the right direction. That's pretty, pretty cool. Jason, I think that was an absolute masterpiece on three topics, actually. Treasury policy, treasury education, and the IACT. Thank you so much for coming on the show. Anything that we didn't mention among the different topics we've touched upon that you want to add?
No, other than I think, you know, it's important for people who have an interest in treasury to have a way of discussing something that's interesting with peers, with networks, etc. So I think as a community in treasury, the more we can network with each other, the more we can talk to each other, the more we can advance treasury as a profession. So I would encourage everybody out there who really loves this topic, who really loves the area of treasury, to spend time with their peers, to spend time with their networks, and to talk about issues, opportunities, etc., so we can advance the profession as best as possible.
Jason, if people would like to know more about you, we didn't talk about it, we touched upon it in the introduction of this podcast, but I'm also the co-founder and a CSO at Centrus. If people want to know more about you, Centrus, the IACT, whatever you're doing at Trinity College Dublin, which is where you teach students about treasury, where should people go?
Reach out to me on LinkedIn. I'm easy to find. Or send me an email, jason.murphy@centrusadvisors.com. I'm sure you can stick it up on the podcast. An email or reach out to me on LinkedIn. Delighted to talk to people.
Amazing. Jason, thank you so much.
Thanks again, Guillaume.